Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Struggle Session. I'm Leslie III.
And I'm Jack Allison.
And today we have a very special guest. We're going to be talking about their new book, a very interesting nonfiction book. It's called Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fuels the Right. It's going to be out January 19th from Haymarket Books. Our guest today, Brendan O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My book is about looking at the far right and the ongoing and cascading crises of capitalism, specifically through the lens of immigration and movements around nativism and attempts to restrict immigration to the United States. It's a pretty US-centric book, but many of the phenomena I'm reporting on and analyzing are manifesting in different ways in other countries, but my focus is on the US. And it is also about kind of the struggle between different factions of the ruling class, those that are more aligned with industries that rely on migrant labor, and then some industries that rely on deporting migrant labor, and the contradictions there, and the contradictions between capitalists and folks that are more interested in doing racist stuff.
where does sort of capitalism end and just, you know, racism begin, and where and are the two kind of one and the same? Do they both serve each other, you know?
So that's a tension that the book really tries to explore and tease out. One of the things that really became clear to me over the course of my research and reporting in this area has been the dynamic that it seems to me has been sort of the paradigm when it comes to migrant labor and the enforcement of immigration law over the course of the past half century or so, which is to say that having a strain of anti-immigrant nativist politics serves the interests of the capitalist class insofar as it facilitates the creation of a hyper-exploitable, undocumented underclass, a layer of the American working class that is even less able to avail itself of the already limited rights that that workers in this country have. And so in order to do that, however, the sentiments around nationalism, around nativism, around the construction and defense of whiteness need to be mobilized in a way that I think what, you know, we are seeing now is it's taking on a life of its own, essentially. That those forces have their own set of interests and their own kind of material incentives that are not necessarily always aligned with parts of the ruling class that ushered them into being in the first place.
I did find the book very interesting, but when I was reading it, I couldn't help but think to myself, most of these problems were solved already when Joe Biden won the presidency.
Right. Trump's out, so white nationalism is over.
Yeah.
So sorry that it's unfortunate your book's going to come out one. There's going to be kind of one day of relevance before Joe Biden gets inaugurated, unfortunately.
You know, I bet big and I lost, and that's okay. That's the way that it goes.
You bet. That's what happens when you bet big on racism. Unfortunate. The point is that Leslie's making him, of course, but, you know, as you go into the book, of course, it's like, you know, the last, like, you know, this is bipartisan. If you look across, like, the last, like, I think it was all the way back to Clinton, it's like, how many millions of people have been deported? It has been, like, completely, like, hyperinflated, it feels like, since the 90s.
Yeah. The legislation that Democrats ushered through, in the crime bills of the mid-90s, not only expanded domestic policing, but also expanded the immigration enforcement mechanisms that the Bush administration continued to build up, the Obama administration continued to build up, and that then the Trump administration inherited. The incoming Joe Biden administration has made it very clear that they will continue to prioritize enforcement of the border and continue to deport people, continue to maintain these ways of managing migrant labor in a really brutal way. But what they will try to do is return it to the pre-Trump status quo, where it was just hidden away. And it was...
The child prisons aren't going anywhere, but we're not going to be like specifically trying to separate families with policy, right? Like, I think that's the idea, is that it's like if people arrive unaccompanied, but we're still going to arrest people and deport them and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also, I think some of what the Trump administration introduced into the discourse and not just discursively, but materially, is kind of the spectacle of the brutality that these, you know, that the Trump administration specialized in. That, like, that is a new thing and has its own logic to it. For me, it's helpful to kind of think about an analogy to the Obama administration's embrace of drone warfare, where they're still killing people, but doing it in a way that is kind of hidden behind computers. And Joe Biden has specifically pushed for, you know, the expansion of not a wall, but a smart wall, and the expansion of surveillance technology on the border that has the same end result of pushing people who are making the crossing from from Mexico into the US out into the desert, which essentially has become a mass grave, but doing so in a way that involves greater plausible deniability for the administration.
Right.
So that's going to keep happening. And workers who try to stick up for themselves on the job who are undocumented will always have the threat of deportation hanging over their head. You know, these kinds of more mundane forms of violence will continue unless something really radical changes.
Yeah, you mentioned in the last chapter that in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, who is considered like a liberal and very anti-Trump, said that the solution to the immigration crisis is a high wall with a big gate, but a smart gate. So it's, instead of build the wall, it's build the wall and the smart gate into the wall. And that is going to be less racist.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this kind of gives the game away on, as you were saying, Jack, that this is really a bipartisan project with slightly different versions of, or slightly different ideas about how to carry this out. But this is about regulating the entry and exit of labor and determining who is eligible to come into this country according to metrics that, if I recall correctly, Freeman in that piece is talking about like IQ and like all of this stuff that's like, dude, like this is just as eugenicist the more vulgar expressions that we get from Trump.
And even, of course, if you want to get back to, you know, and I think you touched on it even in the beginning of your book, it's like, what the start of this country was eradicating indigenous people. Yeah. And so we've kind of like come in, eradicated all the indigenous people, and then like erected walls and said, like, stay out. You know what I mean? It's like, we, you know, we've, and subsequently also, you know, as everybody knows, we've like caused a lot of the, you know, terror that has led to the mass migrations and everything, you know, that that are even causing people to need to come up to this particular latitude.
Yeah, that's precisely right.
What I find, you know, probably the most interesting aspect of your book is that not only are you writing this from the perspective of, you know, the broad left, but from a socialist perspective, and you make a socialist argument against borders when after There was a lot of this going around after Bernie Sanders lost, that the problem with his campaign was that he was talking about open borders and people don't want that, and the left should actually be for like strict borders,
right?
And
this stricter. Kind of like Tucker Carlson populism or something.
Yeah, I mean, that whole conversation that seems to ebb and flow strikes me as very silly, in as much as Bernie was assuredly not talking about open borders.
Yeah.
Yeah. But although yes. to the Sanders campaign's credit, its 2020 immigration platform was, I think it is fair to say, by far and away the most left-wing of certainly anybody running in this campaign, and possibly even ever for a Democrat. In so much as he embraced decriminalizing border crossings and dismantling the most repressive parts of the immigration enforcement apparatus. But I do think that there is still a real substantive conversation that needs to happen within the growing socialist and workers movement in this country about the function of borders and the function of border mm-hmm. enforcement, and how that relates to our wider project of liberation. And I think that even with the kind of abolitionist movement stepping into the void that the Sanders campaign left this summer and into the fall, even still, there has not been, I think, a sufficiently robust analysis of how local police and state police and sheriff's departments fit into the larger immigration enforcement machinery. To say that, you know, we want to abolish police and prisons, what that actually would mean as well for undocumented workers,
mm-hmm.
and why those struggles and how those struggles are linked.
Because if we defund the police, who will put the kids in cages? Because we tend to think it's just ICE for some reason.
Right.
Certain people think that it's just ICE, but no, it's actually local PDs.
Well, and also, you know, it's like, you know, when sort of all the like Occupy ICE stuff was going on, you end up finding out, oh, there's a lot of like intermingled facilities. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's a lot of people that are just, you know, in prison for, you know, immigration crimes that are just, you know, and with everybody else, I guess.
Yeah. And I think also the Occupy ICE moment was particularly revealing insofar as many of those encampments around the country, when they were not being hassled by local PDs or the ICE and DHS agents whose buildings they were protesting against, were getting harassed, were getting attacked by
mm-hmm.
non-uniformed fascists. And
right.
this was a moment when I think it became very clear the practical and ideological unity between these growing formations on the far right outside of the state that have sometimes a kind of hostile relationship with law enforcement, but ultimately understand that they are kind of on the same side. And when in these kinds of moments, when they have a shared target in the left, they very much embrace that and make their allegiances known.
Man, you had an interesting article. I think Vice titled it, was it like takes you aren't allowed to have, or
Unthinkable ideas.
Unthinkable ideas. Yeah. And your unthinkable idea was building a global abolition movement. And what I like about your book is you talk about how the way to fight back against this nativism is, you know, global solidarity, because mm-hmm. you actually were able to speak with people across the world who were part of this global abolition movement.
Yeah. And to be clear, it's not my idea to have it.
Very clever. Very clever to come up with everybody working together like that.
Vice gave you credit for it, though.
um, yeah, so Vice commissioned me to work on this piece, and it was a great opportunity because something that I had been thinking a lot about over the summer was, you know, what we mean when we really say a world without police or prisons. And many prominent theorists of abolition and scholars of abolition will speak about the internationalist aspect of prison and police abolition. But especially in the US, the left is very bad at doing internationalism in a practical way. I mean, we can put out statements, we can do tweets calling Juan Guaido a piece of shit, but like, mm-hmm. to kind of be like real about it is going to take a little bit more work. And so what I was interested in trying to do with this piece is talking to organizers, abolitionist organizers around the world involved in building abolitionist struggles in different contexts to learn about how, well, for one thing, how they see what's happening in the US, but ultimately how they see all of these different struggles relating to each other. Yeah, it was a pretty remarkable experience to be able to get so many different perspectives on this question of policing and police violence and the role of these institutions in different contexts. Yeah, I mean, it all just boils down to like, fuck the police, like in different languages.
You know, we're talking about this book from a socialist perspective, but this book is really, I think, aimed at a pretty broad audience. It might open with a quote from Rosa Luxemburg, but anybody who is just like, I think the average resistor would like learn a ton from this
book. But also, even as somebody who, you know, has read theory and stuff like that, like it is always kind of nice. It's nice to not assume too much of people. You know what I mean? It's kind of nice to have it all laid out in the sort of complete sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a complicated history, and much of it was obscure to me and remains obscure to me. But what do I hope people will take away from it? I think that even though Joe Biden has won the presidency and is going to be our next president, these questions of the relationship between capital and race and nationhood, and as they're like kind of mediated by nativist ideologies and far right political formations, are going to be, I think, really paradigmatic in the years to come, which is to say that issues of movement and migration and displacement, as the political crises deepen, as the financial crises deepen, and especially as the climate crisis deepens, more and more people are going to be uprooted from their homes and will not have the choice to be able to stay where they are, and are going to be internally displaced and are going to be externally displaced, and many of them will come to the United States. And in the US and in Europe, I think it's more than fair to say that like the amount of immigration that we've seen in the past 30 years is a fraction of what's coming. And already we have seen what an outsized reaction there has been to that.
Right.
And I think that this is kind of just the beginning, and that, as I was saying before, it needs to be a central part of our analysis and our practice as we build our socialist movements.
Another point, even just in sort of like the practical sense, is that the right, you know, in the practical sense for the left to have a coherent argument on this and a coherent vision on this, is that the right does have a coherent vision on this. And they have like been beating, I mean, they have like a somewhat coherent vision, and they have been beating the drum for many, many years. And they are making it a central part. It's, you know, a big part of why Trump was president. It's a big part of his support in general. You know, for the left to kind, you know, the left needs to have an answer for that, because, you know, this this stuff clearly does, you know, resonate with people and is obviously going to, you know, continue to snowball larger and larger as we get into this century.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
The book will be out January 19th. Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fused the Right. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you?
people can find me on Twitter at _Grendan, Grendan. Yeah, that's probably the best place to find me.
And yeah, the book is really great. Check it out. It's got a lot of like really great firsthand reporting. You like really get in like the thick of like, you know, you really fucking go there with all this shit. You really go through the book and I'm like, wow, this guy really fucking like had to go and do a lot of real deal fucking reporting for this. It's not one of these like just reading a bunch of research books. So, you know, that's good shit.
Yeah, you tie so many things together and like Jack said, like there's not a coherent vision about this and you try to offer one, which is one of global solidarity and a borderless world, and I don't think that is what cost Bernie Sanders the election.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was Struggle Session. Have a good one.